Today's program features part two of our conversation with Rania Masri. Then we visit Burj Al Barajneh, one of the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. Rania Masri is a writer, activist, and professor in Lebanon. She is an Arab American and was a person of color activist in the United States, where she lived for about 20 years. WERU spoke with Masri in a Beirut restaurant on July 2nd. In that conversation, we explored the significance of the date in which colonial powers conquered Palestine, as well as the factors contributing to the despair among Palestinian youth. Masri also outlined the concept of full citizenship and phantomized Palestinian landmarks. To recap where we left off, the former Minister of Education in Lebanon banned the teaching of Palestinian history and geography. The current Minister of Education in Lebanon has promised to reinstate these subjects into the curriculum. Here, we rejoin the conversation.
But even then, let's say they teach, how do they teach Palestine? How far back in history do they go? So, of course, it's critical that we understand from 1897, the Zionist plot to steal our land and to, dispossess us of our villages and of our homes, and a dispossession and an ethnic cleansing that has been ongoing since the 1930s in Palestine. It's ongoing. Ethnic cleansing has not stopped. You know, home demolitions have not stopped. The killings, the mass killings of Palestinians have not stopped since the 30s. It's critical for us to understand that. It's also critical for us to understand that there was a liberation struggle from Lebanon for Palestine from the 30s. You know, that people fought side by side in what is now Lebanon and Palestine for the liberation of Palestine. It's important people also realize that when Israel was created on the land of Palestine, they also took seven Lebanese villages in southern Lebanon, became what is now what they claim to be northern Israel. Okay, so seven villages, which is how then the size of Lebanon decreased from 10,800 square kilometers to 10,452 square kilometers. But now we are taught that Lebanon is 10,452 square kilometers rather than what it was, you know, in 47, 46, 10,800 square kilometers. You know, we only got our so-called independence in 43, by the way. Palestine was stolen in 48. If those dates had been switched, when the Palestinians would have come up north, they would not have been refugees. You know, and that would have changed so much. When the Armenians came from the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, and they came, there was no Lebanese state. So when the Lebanese state was declared in 43, the Armenians automatically became Lebanese citizens. So we never had Armenian refugees. When you think about these dates, when we understand that it's the same colonial powers that occupied Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, and they decided when they were going to grant us independence, and they decided when they were going to grant the official conquering of Palestine in 48, I don't think those dates are by chance. I don't think it's just 43 will create Syria and Lebanon and give them independence, and 48 we will officially take over 77% of the historic land of Palestine.
Our conversation then shifted to the high dropout rate among Palestinian youth in Lebanon, a figure that had seemed surprising given Palestinians' willingness to sacrifice a lot for their children's education.
So how would you account for that high dropout rate?
Several reasons. One is the state of the education system itself. And I'm sure you can talk at length with UNRWA teachers who can talk to you about the very, very difficult state that they have and in the materials that they have to teach. And of course, then it is in what is being taught. So there's that aspect. The second aspect is the very, very, very high level of poverty within the Palestinian camps. And we all understand that poverty is by design artificial. There is no natural poverty. You know, it's not that you are naturally rich and I'm naturally poor. Okay. So once we understand that concept, then the next question becomes, well, who made the Palestinians poor? And what are the causes behind these high levels of poverty? Okay. So, of course, the first reason is the dispossession from their land in 48 and onwards. The second reason is that the high rates of discriminatory legislation coming from the Lebanese government against Palestinians. Okay. Discriminatory legislation that was empowered by former Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, who increased the levels of tightening on Palestinian employment and denied Palestinians the right to inherit land. So not only are you not allowed to own land, but if your father happened to own land, he cannot give you that land as your, you know. And, you know, that has only gotten worse. Okay. So you have that level of poverty and that level of, let's say you do manage to make it through school and you do manage to get a scholarship somehow and finance your way to a university degree. Okay. You can't work in a white-collar position in Lebanon. Okay. And it's very difficult for you to travel outside the country because you are a stateless individual. You don't have a passport. You have another kind of document. And this document is not, it's not as if the doors are open for you when you travel. Okay? So then the employment spaces that you have left for you in Lebanon become very, very small. Okay? You add that with the high level of unemployment that is already in Lebanon, which is really high, and the high level of poverty that's already in Lebanon. Okay, so then, to me, it is understandable that given all of these situations together, you would have a high dropout rate. Okay, so you have the state within the school system, the difficulty that the schools are facing. Okay, be it the material, be it the capacity, be it what is taught. Okay, you have the poverty within the camps, the high level of poverty within the camps. You have the high level of poverty that's been increasing outside the camps that's influencing everybody in the country. You have the high level of unemployment within the camps, the high level of unemployment outside of the country, and then you have the high level of discriminatory Lebanese legislation that influences and increases the unemployment and the poverty that further weakens one's sense of motivation for education. On top of all of these situations, there's been an increasing sense of despair among our community because the sense of hope that we have in liberating our land has been declining. Okay, so it's not as if all of these issues were present in the 70s. Okay, if we have all of the situation present and we are living in the 60s or 70s, when there was a higher sense of hope, where there was a stronger organization, a stronger organized system of resistance within the camps and outside the camps, then people can say, yes, despite it all, I will resist. Okay? And they could be part of that movement that is larger than themselves. There is no movement larger than oneself that is strong and organized and successful currently within the camps. So it makes it even more difficult. Okay? So it's like the perfect storm, if you could use that expression.
The jobs in Lebanon for which Palestinians are banned or for which they must overcome huge obstacles range from social workers to public transportation drivers, doctors to tourist guides, accountants to sellers of tobacco products, engineers to opticians, and lab technicians to dietitians. Rania Masri elaborated on the restrictions on employment for Palestinians and the impact it has.
It is very difficult for Palestinians to get employment within 77 jobs. Okay, it's no longer impossible, but the law has shifted just to make it really, really, really difficult. Okay, so we're talking about all kinds of white-collar jobs: nurses, doctors, lawyers, engineers, so on and so forth. They can be carpenters. This is the ongoing statement that comes from the Speaker of the House, but they can be carpenters, they can be plumbers, or they can work as consultants. So you have a lot of them working within NGOs, okay, within consultancy or doing translation or doing that kind of on the side employment. You know, and of course, that has a huge impact on so many things. I mean, even if you look at the proliferation of NGOs in the country, mm-hmm. and the impacts that that has on community building and on identity and on solidarity and on resistance struggles and I think it's deeply problematic.
The restaurant became noisier as it neared the lunch hour. Our conversation moved on to the concepts of full citizenship and phantom landmarks.
I was hoping you could talk about the concept of what you, I believe you described as full citizenship, that intersection of environmental management and management of the environment and human rights.
We're very used to, over the past, I mean, since the Industrial Revolution, this concept that we are citizens of a nation state, and that we are as Homo sapiens, as the enlightened primate, we therefore have the rights to conquer, the rights to transform. We have the right to create private property and to do with it as we wish. We have the right to commodify. It creates a hierarchy of thinking, a hierarchy even of arrogance. And it's one that, I would argue, really, really has been lived. You know, you've taken this concept and made it into a way of life through the Industrial Revolution. Okay, so this hierarchy that gets created also then gets transposed to the human system. Okay, just as we are superior to other primates, and we are superior to non-human animals, and we consider ourselves conquerors over all other sentient beings and non-sentient beings, you know, we also have that same system within our human structure. Okay, so you have the class system, and you have, racism gets promoted, and on and on and on. And I would argue capitalism cannot exist without racism. Cannot have a separation of the two. We need a racist understanding and a racist narrative, okay, to accept the idea that certain people are beneath us, because we need them to be beneath us within a capitalistic economic model. Because capitalism needs to have a layer of unemployment. It needs to have different classes working a range of different fields. And it definitely needs to have disposable people. People that you can dispose of for profit, okay? Just as capitalism needs to have disposable lands. If you are working in the oil industry, you are disposing of that land. We do mountaintop removal in the Appalachian Mountains. What does that mean to the land? We are disposing of it, and we are disposing of the people that live there, okay? So there's that narrative that is essential for capitalism. You know, this is why it offends my scientific sensibilities when people talk about environmental reforms within a capitalistic structure, or people use the concept of a green economy or green capitalism. It's like talking about a kind slavery. It does not work. There is no such thing. There is no kind slave master, and there is no environmental capitalism, because by design, it is built on disposability. It is built on hierarchy, and it is built on constant exponential growth, which are scientific laws, the non-negotiable laws of thermodynamics, the non-negotiable ecological laws of this earth, tell us you cannot have constant growth, because there is a limit. There is a clear limit of resources. There is a clear limit for the speed of renewability. There is a limit, okay? So the whole concept of capitalism is based on a fiction. So I start there, because I think it's absolutely critical to understand that. Now, if we understand that scientifically, and we understand that what that means culturally, and what that means politically, which takes a while for people for us to reach that full grasp, okay? Then what does that mean within citizenship? Who are we? Who's our allegiance to? What does that mean if I say I am a citizen of the Lebanese state? What does that actually mean? Whose voices are heard, whose voices are not heard, whose voices am I responsible for, what does it mean with regards to private property? I mean, the whole concept of private property, I believe to be, it's a very new concept in human history, and it is a very destructive concept for the environment, and I would argue it's also a very destructive concept for other human communities, not simply, non-human animal communities. So what would that full citizenship look like? How could we get there? What would it mean? You know, so we're talking about the deconstruction of all our paradigms, of all our narratives that we have grown up with, and the reconstruction of our old narratives, the narratives that have been historic for thousands of years, where we lived a different life, and where our relationships with the earth were a different kind of relationship, and our relationships with each other were not built on a cash nexus, but were built on a human nexus. So how do we do that transformation? The good news, I argue, is with climate change, mm-hmm. and with the massive, massive horrors that have already come and that are coming, there will be a social and economic transformation of our communities. So there's a sliver of an opportunity that maybe amidst the horror that is coming, there may be a rebirth of something good, and we may be able to move to the left rather than to move to a more fascist, divisive, destructive community. But then that all depends on the power of the left.
Writer, activist, and professor in Lebanon, Rania Masri, spoke to WERU in a Beirut, Lebanon restaurant in July 2017. Rania Masri's blog is greenresistance.wordpress.com. Among her posts is one about phantom landmarks.
I wondered if you would use that same concept to speak about the Palestinian villages that were raised, destroyed, and then other communities were built in that space, but it still may have that same name.
The vast majority of Palestinian villages still exist. The Zionists continue to say that the ones that claim to be liberal Zionists, which is my, the equivalent term would be a feminist slave owner, non-existent. But they claim that Palestinians can't return, not only because they're not Jews, but there's no space for them. But there actually is, because the vast majority of Palestinian villages that they were forced by gunpoint to leave in 47, 48, 49 still exist, in the sense that they have not been transformed into these ugly fake settlements. So these Palestinian villages, then, what the Jewish National Fund has been doing is covering them with trees, many of which are exotic trees or fast-growing trees or trees that end up actually looking like soldiers. Okay? And then they transform them into parks. So then you can go as a Zionist or as somebody who's trying to be persuaded of the virtues of this evil and walk amidst this park, and you see the destroyed homes, and you're being told that these are archaeological ruins. Okay. Meanwhile, the Palestinians can't even go back to those so-called parks. So they still exist, and you have attempts that certain Palestinian communities within 1948 Palestine still do, because some Palestinians were expelled from their villages in 48 and forced to go very large distances and ended up in Lebanon. Some succeeded in only going a short distance, so they were moved from their home village to a rural area where then they set up one of the unrecognized villages. Okay, so they come from this new village to go back to their old village, and they do these yearly meetings. So they constant a remembering of their history, a remembering of their identity, and a reclaiming of the village. So in many ways, yes, they are phantom landmarks, but I would prefer to call them phantomized landmarks, in the sense that you have the Zionists are trying to make these landmarks become phantom landmarks, and the Palestinians are constantly living them, so not allowing them to become phantom, to make them into reality constantly, constantly, constantly.
For Rania Masri, the struggles in Lebanon are a sign of an active resistance movement.
We have every struggle you can imagine. So in one way, it's a diverse, very rich country of struggle. But we can also look at a struggle in a different way, because you can look at, when I say we have every struggle imaginable, then you could say, oh my God, they have so many problems. Or you can look at it as to say, people are resisting. Okay, and people are resisting. And I think we spend so much of our time and our energy looking at the horrors that we're facing, you know, be it in the United States or be it in this region. But I also believe we have to spend an equal amount of energy looking at the way people are organizing and historically have been organizing, and the way that different narratives are being created or being resurrected, and the way that these organizational models and these narratives and these everyday struggles are critical, not only for our personal spiritual strength to go on, but also for our understanding that, you know, just like Howard Zinn says, we can look at our history as a history of defeats or as a history of constant struggle for liberation. And that's how I see our community, the Lebanese, Palestinian, and Syrian community, as historically we have been fighting occupation for hundreds of years, literally for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, from the Ottoman Empire to the French and the British, and now the Israeli occupation, and of course we still have the U.S. occupation in Iraq, we have U.S. threats of occupation in Syria, so we're still fighting.
In Burj al Barajneh, one of 12 Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, the electricity and water lines sag in a tangle just a couple feet above my head as I walk along the narrow alleys between houses. Most passageways are wide enough only for a scooter. Sahar Sirhan has met me at the camp entrance and tells me that one or two people are electrocuted each year because of the haphazard wiring. We walk to the Social Support Society's Active Aging House, which Sirhan manages. She is a resident of this camp that is only 1 square kilometer, but home to approximately 25,000 residents. We arrive at the Active Aging House around 11 a.m. on June 30th to find a couple dozen elders sitting in a circle socializing. It is Friday, so they will have an early lunch together before the midday prayer.
We have 40% or 50% living alone.
Yeah.
Not have a family and the children. All of them are dreams to return in Palestine, really.
They are children of the Nakba, coming to Lebanon in 1948 when they were 2, 4, maybe 12 years old. In 2017, they are still living here in a refugee camp. At this active aging house, 60 elders engage in a variety of activities from painting and basket weaving to playing basketball, getting their blood pressures checked, and gaining literacy skills. The active aging house has a second location in Nahr el-Barad camp, and on Saturdays, some go to Souq Tayyab in Beirut to sell some of their traditional Palestinian food. Sahar Sirhan helps me interview some of the elders, including one of the younger ones, Mariam Sharkia, age 64. Sharkia's parents fled Danun, Palestine, a village near Acre, in 1948, during the Nakba. The attack on the village came at night. It was midnight or 1 a.m., and planes were flying overhead, terrifying the villagers. Some villagers fled without shoes. Sharkia's parents had 2 sons at the time. Mariam was not yet born, and her mother thought she had run out of the house with both sons. It later turned out that what she had grabbed was not her sleeping baby, but a pillow. In her panic, she'd accidentally left 1 son behind. I asked Mariam to repeat this, unsure I heard her correctly. Mariam tells me that when her parents realized their mistake, they asked everyone about their son. No one had seen him. When I first arrived at the active aging house, everyone was lively. Mariam Sharkia was smiling and happy to tell her story as others had. But now she is crying. So after a pause, I return to what gives her joy, the center. Sirhan interprets.
How do you feel at this center?
شو بتشعري بالسنتر هون؟
هون السنتر هون حياتي. يعني
this center have the life.
أنا بحس براحة هون. بعدين أنا باجي الساعة 8 الصبح.
She's feel happy, and she's come at 8 o'clock every day in the morning.
لا بكون كتير مبسوطة. أنا لما بدي
أضحك.
أنا لما بدي أضحك بضحك هون. برا ما بضحك.
When you want to laugh, she's here.
Glass bottles holding soil from different villages in Palestine line the center's bookshelves. That wraps up our program for today. The first part of WERU's conversation with Rania Masri can be found online in the WERU News Program Archives. Thank you for listening. I'm Carolyn Coe.